Marika wrote her PhD on syntactic variation and change in Welsh at the University of Leiden, and she works on comparative syntax and descriptive and historical linguistics at Cambridge. She's also worked at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. And she is developing annotated historical corpora of Tibetan, Mongolian, Welsh, and the bit that I can personally attest to, Anglo-Norman Middle English, and medieval Latin as well. Today, she is speaking on how historical corpora can verify predictive pathways of language change. Thank you, Marika.
Thank you very much for the introduction and for inviting me here. So, I'd like to talk to you today about how we can study language change, and then I'm talking specifically about historical language change, and that is, let's say, in the age before books were printed in particular. And I'm going to argue that in order to do that, in order to answer the how and why of language change in those periods, what we really need is very well annotated historical corpora. I'm going to illustrate that with three little case studies, one on semantic change, one pragmatic, and one on syntactic change. So let's start with semantics. Now, take the word darling in English. We all know in present-day English what that means. And the word existed in Old English as well. So Old English, the period before 1150, let's say. In Old English, however, the word darling actually meant something slightly different. It was the king's darling, was really his favorite. It was, let's say, the hand of the king, not really one of his lovers. So if you put the word darling in, let's say, the Ngram viewer of Google Books, then you see something like this. And, you know, beginning of the 17th century and, let's say, the end of the 19th century, there are some spikes there. If you compare it to the word sweetheart, you can put multiple words in Google Ngram viewer, you see that darling is used more frequently. But does that really tell us anything? Does that tell us anything about the meaning of it? Well, no, this is just frequencies, really. Other than end of the 19th century, people had more of an interest in the word darling, it doesn't really tell us anything. Now, let's look at a couple of other words then in Old English that have sort of changed their meaning. For example, the word for wife, present-day English, existed in Old English, but again, meant something quite differently. It could be a married woman, but in fact, it was also just a woman, just any woman. Now, the word for man in Old English, or one of the words for man in Old English, could be wer. Now, in modern English, in present English, we don't really have the word wer anymore, but we do have the word werewolf, which is actually man-wolf. So we have some traces of it, but we don't use the word anymore. Whereas queen, in present English, we all know what that means. In Old English, it meant queen, but it could also mean just any woman, or a wife, for that matter. Now, the changes that you saw here, the definitions that I put up, are from a dictionary. So these are sort of lexical semantics that I'm talking about. There's also another way of doing semantics, and that is by looking at the context. And this is called distributional semantics. And J.R. Firth put that really nicely in the 1950s, saying, "You shall know a word by the company it keeps." Now, he's building on work by others as well, but the main idea is that you look at the context, and from that, a word gets its meaning. Well, we can look at the context with Google Books as well. That's nice. We can actually say or tell it to look for, let's say, the two words preceding darling the most frequently over time. And if we do that, we get a list that looks like this. Now, if we zoom in a little bit, you can see that the word my occurs very frequently next to darling, my darling. And then second, the word my, again, with a capital letter, occurs very frequently next to the word darling. So actually looking at these lists of collocations can tell us something, but it doesn't tell us an awful lot. especially if you look at a list like that. Now, what you can also do, instead of a list, you can visualize it. And this is what anyone can do as well. You go to Sketch Engine, and Sketch Engine bases it, well, at least this corpus is, again, the Google Books corpus. And you can look for, let's say, all the instances of Darling in the 15th and 16th century and plot this nice diagram here where Darling is quite close to, well, dainty, apparently. It's used a lot with dear darling, pretty darling, her darling. And then there's some other stuff in here. Now, in the 17th century, as I said, little spike there in the early 17th century, awful lot going on. So darling is used for similar words here, but then there's also sin and lust and corruption. So seems to change a little bit, but what can it really tell us? Well, if you look further in time, and I don't want to waste too much time on these, because you can all go online and plot them, it's actually not very, very insightful. You can see some changes, but you can't really quantify it. You can't really do much other than showing pretty pictures, right? So 18th century darling, 19th century darling looks quite empty, despite the big spike there. But that's also because there was an awful lot written at the end of the 19th century. So it's not just the word darling that appears a lot, but it's other words that appear an awful lot as well. Right. So we need actually a little bit of a better method to looking at semantics. And of course, you're all aware that recently, things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, they've had huge success. Now, if machines are so good at learning stuff, could they actually learn semantics? Well, if you take the distributional hypothesis and looking at the context, if you give a computer an awful lot of context, it turns out it can actually learn the semantics surprisingly well. So what people have been doing is, because computers can't read, obviously they have to turn everything into numbers. So they turn the context into numbers, and I won't go into the details of how that process really happens, but they create a big vector, a series of numbers for every single word. So if you give it a word like Germany and Berlin, for example, you give it lots and lots of texts to train on. If you then give it Spain, it can actually calculate that the capital of Spain is Madrid. So it's actually quite good in having sort of semantic reasoning. Now, these types of numbers are then called word vectors or word embeddings, and they've really boosted performance in a lot of computational, and especially natural language processing tasks. The prime example, and that's what makes this interesting, that you probably all heard of, but I'm going to go through it quickly anyway, is what they call the word maths of this. So this is from the original Word2Vec paper, where you can have the word for king, let's say, turn into a bunch of numbers. You can subtract the word for man, then add the word for woman, and then you get the word for queen. So the way this works is that these vectors are multidimensional, at least 100 dimensions, sometimes 200, 300, depends a little bit on how big your corpus is. Now, it's very difficult to display 100 dimensions, so I squashed it into two dimensions here, and then this is what you get. So you get sort of queen and king up there, quite close to each other, in the same sort of configuration as man and woman are quite close to each other. So if you subtract man from king and then add woman, you actually automatically end up with the vector that happens to be the closest vector to queen. So you can do word maths, which is quite cool. And it works very well for a lot of, let's say, recent synchronic semantic approaches. But how do we calculate change then? If you can do this synchronically, then it would be nice to do this diachronically as well. Well, actually, here are some issues. And there's quite a few people who've been looking into this. One of them actually sitting in this room, so Chaim Dubosarski and others, they've pointed out that actually the data sets in diachronic word embeddings are sometimes, they're a bit noisy. There's a lack of consistent methods. There's also not really very good gold, let's say, data to test our models for this. So that means that we don't really know what the answer is, so we cannot really compare it to a good answer. Now, fortunately, Chaim and his team have found very clever solutions for that, but I won't go into that because I understand he's presenting a poster on that, so if you're interested, you need to go to his poster later. And they've applied that to the Google Books corpus as well and made sure that sort of all these issues have overcome. So look again at this plot for Darling and Sweetheart from the Google Books corpus. And notice this. So it starts at 1500, or sort of 1500. You see that there's not an awful lot of data from the early 16th century. Now, what I'm really interested in is actually the time before that. So Old English, Middle English, as I said, or let's say older stages of other languages like Tibetan and Welsh, as Laura pointed out. How do we do that? Well, there are actually some more issues, if you look at it. We can't really use a big web corpus of Old English for the simple reason that the Anglo-Saxons were not very prolific. So Alfred spent a lot of time fighting and farming, let's say, not a lot of time writing, because most people were illiterate, let's face it. So we don't have big data, and this is a severe problem for lots of, well, techniques that we want to do. Also, even if people wrote things down, they didn't really agree yet on how to write that. There was no standardization of orthography, so that is a big problem. Also, Old English had case endings, which made the word king appear in, let's say, not just one nice form or two forms as we have in modern English, like king and kings, but over 100 different forms that, frankly, all mean the same thing. So from a semantic point of view, you don't want that. And remember that computers can't read, so they will treat all these 100 instances as different variations, let's say. Now, that's not good for what we want to achieve. And that means, as well, if you try and plot this, if you subtract man from king and then add woman, you don't actually end up with a nice word vector like this. So you don't end up with a word for queen in Old English. It doesn't work very well, this Old English word maths. In fact, if you do this, what you end up with is an awful lot of other words for king, but spelled slightly differently. And then some names like Knut and Harald, you know, they were kings, but they were definitely not queen. And then Normandy pops up as well. So the answer to this is, in order to apply, let's say, these methods, what we need is better corpora. We need well-annotated historical corpora in the sense that, well, let's say a little bit more of an advanced version than what monks were doing with their glosses in medieval manuscripts. We need better digitized and more advanced ways of adding information to our corpus to make sure that we can use it in research. And this has to do with, as I said, spelling regularization, lemmatization, adding morphosyntactic information in the form of part of speech, parsing, etc. So I did a little bit of that for Old English. After a little bit of regularization, a little bit of lemmatization, and using bits of the Old English corpus that have been part of speech tagged, what you get, actually, is a much better picture. So you get queen and king up there together, which is, you know, a better result. Man and woman down here. So if you look and compare before annotation, if you looked at words like queen, then closest to queen were other words for queen, but slightly different spelling. And then there were names of queens like Eormenhild and Agathon. And there's the word quith, which just means say. So queens apparently said a lot of things in Old English manuscripts, but that doesn't really make it the same. Now, after a little bit of this annotation, so after some regularization, some lemmatization, actually, if you look at words that are close to queen, then king now appears in the top 10. Not quite on the top, but, you know, dochter. So this is daughter and stepdaughter are closer, but that is already a much better result. Now, of course, more needs to be done to make these results perfect, but you can see that it's clearly a step in the right direction. Even if you now do your Old English word math, you can subtract man, add wife or woman, and then you get things like daughter and stepdaughter as well, which is already a lot better than just 10 other words for king. Okay, pragmatic change then. We're not just interested in semantics, the meaning of words, but also in how words can mean, let's say, slightly and used in a slightly different way. So I'm going to talk a little bit about ugly dukelings, especially the ling suffix. So diminutive suffixes in English, there are loads of them. And the nice thing is that they're very clear at the end of words. And even, you know, if you don't know, let's say, all the words in English, you very, very quickly learn everything about diminutives. It's very insightful morphology. So et, let, ling, etc. If you see a word like oubliette, then you can immediately infer that that must be a diminutive. Now, we can use that by actually splitting off some of these morphological endings. And some of these in Old English were ock, in which we still have, in hillock, and buttocks, bollocks, intil, which we don't have anymore. Then there was a ling, which we still have, it meant usually son of in English, in Old English. And then a little bit later on from Old Norse, we got another ling suffix, which was really the core diminutive. So that was for small things. Now again, if you look at the dictionary, the ock suffix, it says that a number of words in ock seem to share a general sense of rounded protuberance. So there's a round sense to the words that end in ock, not just diminutive. Now, for ling, actually, it says that now they're always used in contemptuous and unfavorable senses. But before the 17th century, that was not very well established. Now, the other ling is also chiefly used contemptuously. So especially when you call persons like godling, lordling, kingling. Now, to test this hypothesis, could we do the same thing that we did before, but just for the suffixes? Right. So I've done that for Old English. And as you see here, ock and inchel are quite close together with young, definitely meaning something like young, little, etc. Ling, however, is a bit further away. And that's not really surprising because we have these different senses of ling anyway. So it was not really core diminutive until after the Old Norse came in. Now, various adjectives that go with it. There was no bad yet in Old English, so I used evil and foul. They all end up here, so that's not really telling. Now, if you look at Middle English, inchel disappeared, but ock and ling are still quite far apart. But here you can see that ling is definitely closer to the good and the evil than it was before. Now, early modern English shows that actually, there's a new suffix coming in, let and et from French. And you see that ling and ock then appear together, but not in contexts where this let appears. And if you add round to it, remember our definition from the dictionary that round appears, well, ock things happen to be round. Well, if you add that, you see that ock is indeed moving closer to round, but ling is staying up there. So it tells you a little bit about the semantics. Now, again, there's a lot more work that needs to be done here to make these results perfect. For one thing, you need to make sure that if you really want to show change, that you chop things up in little pieces. But for these suffixes, diminutive suffixes, they don't appear a lot. And there's only so much Old English we have, about 3 to 4 million words. So that's nice, but that's not really enough to do that in little stages. So that's why I lump them together now. But again, after a lot of lemmatization, et cetera, you get a lot better results. Right, then finally, syntactic change. So this is about, let's say, subject, verb, and object order, or subject, object, verb order. So in English, we have SVO these days, at least. Old English, not so much. There was OV, and that object-verb order is hypothesized to, let's say, change to verb-object, but not really the other way around. And this hypothesis comes from theories in formal syntax, especially something that Theresa Bieberauer can tell you everything about, which is the final over final constraint, and work by Ian Roberts in his recent book. There are certain things that can occur in languages. And if you look at comparative syntax and take that very seriously, then you get this sort of hypothesis that it is easy for languages to change from OV to VO, but not the other way around. Can we test that as well? Well, if we look at all the languages that we have information of so far, let's say, this is from the World Atlas of Linguistic Structures. You see an awful lot of red dots, which is verb-object order, over in Africa and in Europe. And then you see an awful lot of object-verb order in the Caucasus and in the Himalayas. You can think of that what you like, but bear in mind that hypothesis that OV order, object-verb, can change to VO. Now, we actually have quite a bit of information from older languages in Western Europe, for example, Latin, and that indicates that some of these red dots here in Western Europe used to be blue. Now, Latin was indeed OV, mostly, let's say, and all of the Romance languages now are SVO, subject, verb, object. So French and Spanish, Italian, etc., all SVO. So a lot of the blue dots here changed into red. Now, a language that I've worked on, Middle Welsh, there actually in Proto-Celtic, you also had OV order. Then the verb started to move forward and ended up at the beginning of the sentence even. So it is now verb initial. Why did that happen here? And let's say, what's going on in the Caucasus and the Himalayas? Are they behind in their syntactic change, maybe? Well, that's a question I hope to answer with the Tibetan corpus that I'm developing. A little example of the Celtic one that I've already done. So if we say that, let's say, Proto-Celtic was probably OV, because we have a lot of continental Celtic languages where the verb is quite late. But then modern Welsh and modern Irish, the verb is initial. In the period in between that, we had Middle Welsh. And in Middle Welsh, the verb already moved up a little bit, but not quite as far. So it's in the middle, let's say it's verb second. And I've done a study of Middle Welsh word order, where you see there's an awful lot of things possible as long as the verb is in the second position. You can have a subject, an object, anything. But the only way, again, to get this information is if you have a well-annotated corpus. So I first had to create a fully parsed historical corpus of Welsh before you can get that data. So to conclude, creating historical corpora is the answer to how and why does language change, especially in historical corpora. For times when we don't have, let's say, Google Books, where we don't have an awful lot of data, it is very, very difficult to get good information unless you actually sit down and spend time trying to, first of all, get all the data that you can get, clean all the data that you can get, make sure that the spelling is regularized. If you want to compare, let's say, the word for king in Old English to Middle English to Modern English, you will have to make sure that the spelling of these words is consistent throughout. So apart from lemmatization, maybe you need even more, and you need to make sure that you regularize it so it looks more like Modern English. So for different techniques, you need different ways of looking into it. But what's important is that you add this information to your corpus, because once you've done that, you can finally start researching these languages, and not just from the year 1500 onwards, but actually go much further beyond. Now, the issue with this is that it takes time, and it's a lot of effort as well. You need to know the languages very well. And that means that it actually costs a lot of money, which is a little bit of a problem, because most funding agencies are not so keen on funding projects that just develop corpora instead of actually doing the research with the corpora. So there's a little bit of an issue there. But I hope that with these three little case studies, I've convinced you that without doing this to historical corpora, there is actually no way we can start answering all these questions for years before 1500 or for languages that are not very well researched. Thank you very much.